From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, it's From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro.
Jerry Beck returns to the show this week. Mr. Beck is the world's foremost authority on the art of the animated cartoon. He is the author of just about a jillion books, and his latest work includes a trio of books on Hanna-Barbera's classic series, The Flintstones, Scooby-Doo, and Tom and Jerry. He provides fascinating commentary tracks on many new DVD cartoon releases, and he writes a blog about cartoons and movies, and yet he still has time for us. Jerry Beck, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
I am very pleased and honored to be here.
Well, I want to hear all about your latest publications, but let's talk a little cartoon history first. Cartoons from the silent era throughout the late 1940s were all produced for theatrical distribution and therefore for adults as well as children, and I think Tom and Jerry fall into that category, but Hanna-Barbera, who worked for MGM Studios, were sort of pioneers in the Saturday morning animation for kids. How did that come about?
Well, it came about because the movie audience was being bifurcated. It was being split by people staying home to watch TV for free, so to speak, and the movie studios really couldn't afford the luxury of having these full programs that they had had for decades before television, where they'd have a newsreel and comedy shorts, cartoons, you know, serial chapters, all sorts of things you'd see when you go to the movies. It really, going to the movies back in the 30s was really kind of akin to staying home tonight and watching cable television. You can watch a full-length movie on TCM or a cartoon on the Cartoon Network and the news on CNN. It was you got all that stuff at the movies in a special program, and the movie studios produced this material. Producing cartoons were the most popular of these short subjects, and they were also the most expensive to produce. They were in color. They took a lot of skilled artists to draw them and to write them and musicians and all the people involved. It was just a big deal. It wasn't like a Three Stooges short, which was just photographed in black and white, you know, in 2 days or something. This took like 6 months to make a cartoon. So when the studios by the mid-50s, you know, realized that they weren't getting the return on these cartoons that they used to get, and it cost so much to make these things, they started to close the departments down that were doing these cartoons, and MGM had their big department with Tom and Jerry, and although Tom and Jerry was still a lucrative merchandising item for them, they felt they had enough cartoons, they could reissue cartoons and make just as much money, and they did that, and they let Hanna and Barbera and their staff go. That was a crisis for Hanna and Barbera and their staff at that time, but they turned it into a wonderful opportunity. Within a year, they made a deal to make cartoons for TV, which had just scarcely been done, and done by the poorest of Hollywood's animators. And here were the kind of the cream of the crop of theatrical animators, and they were willing to do cartoons for TV. The big difference was that they had to do them for a fraction of the kind of money they were doing at MGM, at the Tiffany Studio. They were now doing them, for literally, I'd say, a fraction of the cost. So they had to figure out real quickly where to cut corners, and they cut corners in everything. Well, actually, nothing except the animation, because the designs and the artwork, the stories, and with the characters they created were all top notch. And because of that, that's why they leapt to the fore as the premier makers of cartoons for television with Huckleberry Hound and Yogi Bear. And soon after that, the Flintstones, the Jetsons, Johnny Quest, and on and on and on. So there in a nutshell is the
Hanna-Barbera story. Well, when they, in order to produce cartoons more cheaply for television, that meant less drawings per minute or something?
Yeah, they figured out that it's the drawings, less drawings meant less inking and painting, less paper, less cells, less time under the camera, more time for some of the drawings to be held, but all of that, that's where they saved the money. They had to also churn them out very quickly. And it's funny because when you look at the early Hanna-Barbera cartoons, which are what my books on Hanna-Barbera, they really look good to us now. I mean, because unfortunately, the quality by the 70s and 80s really, really sunk to a lowest bed. And the reason for that was that they started farming out the animation to other countries, which weren't as skilled as they are today. But they were very, very. The animation really got poor in the 70s and 80s.
Were Rough and Ready the first of the Hanna-Barbera characters?
Rough and Ready was the first. It was a. It's rarely shown anymore because the cartoons were serialized, meaning they're little 5-minute cartoons, sort of like Rocky and Bullwinkle, where you know tune in next time to see what happens, kind of a thing. And the thing is, TV programmers throughout the years didn't like that because you'd have to run them in a certain order, otherwise you lose the story.
So they
stopped running them. And Yogi Bear and the other ones, because it didn't matter what order you ran them in.
Rough and Ready, they had a Professor Gizmo. Was that what it? Professor Gizmo? Something like that?
Yes, actually, yeah. And Professor Gizmo was...
And they just blinked their eyes. They hardly had any animation in them at all, if I recall.
Yeah, they're pretty limited. I think that was their first test. I'm kind of glad that, in a weird way, they had greater success with Huckleberry Hound and Yogi Bear, some of the things they had subsequently. And in a way, they deserved that success with those characters. Those characters, sort of like they got the bugs out of the system in that first batch of cartoons. But that was pretty successful. They built a show around it. I think even NBC picked it up to run on what I call the early version of Saturday morning. You know, Saturday morning that we know, the way we think of Saturday morning, which is basically gone today. That Saturday morning didn't really come into being until the mid-60s. Even though they were programming kids' shows as in the 50s, they were mainly things like Lone Ranger and Roy Rogers shows. And
Howdy Doody and stuff?
Yeah, Howdy Doody, right, exactly. And it was all kinds of miscellaneous things. And, of course, shows old, you know, theatricals would get shown as well. But what we think of as Saturday morning started... Oh, somewhere in the... I had to hurt the pinpoint because there's fragments of it as early as, you know, the early 60s. But, you know, you remember that in there, like 64, 65, 66. By 66, we're there.
So I guess this is kind of an obvious question, but why Rough and Ready and not Tom and Jerry? They didn't own the characters of Tom and Jerry?
Yep. MGM owned Tom and Jerry. They definitely were stripped of their signature characters. And MGM later, subsequently... made new Tom and Jerry cartoons with other people, and a few decades later with Hanna-Barbera again for television. But MGM controlled that property.
Well, let's talk about Hanna-Barbera's primetime animation, because they were pioneers there too. Jumping ahead to 1962, I guess it was, when the Flintstones arrived in primetime. Was it right, 62?
It was actually 1960.
60. Obviously, you know, we know the sort of the animated version of the Honeymooners, although I guess today people don't know the Honeymooners and they do know the Flintstones, so.
Well, I'd like to think the Honeymooners is such a classic that people do know it, but
yeah.
There's some, you know, I think that it's sort of iconic in that I Love Lucy kind of way.
Most of the Hanna-Barbera primetime series were actually based on other live-action shows, like Bilko is... Top Cat and things like that, yes?
Yeah. I mean, they were based on previous things. You can sort of see the pitch that they must have given, you know, it's just like Sergeant Bilko, but with cats in an alley, you know. I mean, the Jetsons was sort of a typical domestic sitcom just set in the future, but one could point to Blondie, the old movie series, and I say that because most people don't know Blondie, but it was a comic strip, but it became a movie series of like 20 films in the 40s that starred an actress named Penny Singleton as Blondie. Anyway, she's the voice of Jane Jetson. And I kind of think, the more I look at it, you know, George is sort of a Dagwood, you know, character. You know, they're all really, it looks very based on the Blondie comic strip, actually,
yeah.
If you really look at it close enough. And there was a few others. I mean, they would take characters... and base not them on shows per se, but on personalities. Dawes Butler, who did Yogi Bear, I mean, you know, despite the Flintstones' resemblance to the Honeymooners, there's something about it's kind of an Ed Norton-y thing going on,
right,
with Yogi Bear. You know? And I always like, I could be wrong, but I never heard anybody else say this. but I always thought that the that Huckleberry Hound personality was sort of maybe based on Andy Griffith, but I'm not 100% sure about that. He was definitely in the public eye with that character that he was on the Andy Griffith Show.
Well, it seemed like all of the Hanna-Barbera characters of that era were modeled over somebody. I mean, I can think of Snagglepuss is Bert Lahr, and
that's right.
Megilla Gorilla is Joey Brown, and not Megilla Gorilla.
Right,
it's
right. They did that all the way up.
Peter Potamus, that's the one.
Yeah, I remember that they one of the ones. When you're a kid, you don't know who they're doing. It's kind of fun,
yeah.
You know. But it's like later on when I was like older and they were, you know, doing Jabberjaw and he's sort of like Curly from the Three Stooges, and I was like, I kind of cringed, you know. It just seemed like a ripoff to me. The mother of all of those is Betty Boop, you know, who is based on Helen Keane, a performer who looked like Betty Boop and sounded like Betty Boop, and had a trademark Boop Boop a Doop was part of her trademark line.
Yeah.
And they basically ripped her off, and then she sued Fleischer Studios
and lost
the case somehow. The rest is history. I guess you don't fight the big studios.
So how did America take to the Flintstones?
Oh, the Flintstones was, again, another... the Flintstones was almost as revolutionary as Snow White was when it came out, because it was a cartoon show competing with the sitcoms of the time, which, again, were meant for adults, were shown in prime time. The first sponsor of the Flintstone was Winston Cigarettes, back when they could advertise cigarettes on television.
Yes, the cartoon characters are smoking cigarettes on the show, right?
Yes, that's right. They had them smoking and everything. And so it was, and if you really look at those first two seasons of the Flintstones, those are my favorite. They're really, actually really funny and clever, and the artwork is really especially good looking. It doesn't look like it got what I call standardized later, but the first season in particular is very rough, and it fits the whole Stone Age thing really well. And you can see what the basic appeal of it was. It was a parody of suburban life, the cliche suburban life at the time, being told by animated characters who were set in the Stone Age. So there was just a lot of humor there. It was just such a novelty. It was so unique.
All of the modern conveniences, like the big bird that was the can opener and things like that.
Exactly. And you know what? To a lot of people, that's what they felt these things were. It was almost, it was magic to have all of these modern conveniences and things. And so it was, these are people, when I say modern conveniences, it sounds so archaic, but I remember it because I was a little kid, and my grandparents, come out of the 20s and 30s, and they didn't have... the things, we didn't have electric can openers. They just didn't have the things that we had in the 60s. And then to see them parodied, as being done by birds and turtles and things that were inside, it was great. And so the Flintstones was a big, big hit. And, obviously as the show lasted a few years, Simpsons, of course, has now beaten it by a mile. But... being on, it was on primetime for 6 years, which was a big deal in the 60s, and they had to freshen it up with, it got very gimmicky later. They first brought in, they had Wilma get pregnant, which obviously right there alone, a cartoon character is pregnant and having a baby. The whole thing is kind of ridiculous, but
yeah.
They had that happen, that kind of mimicked the whole Lucy pregnancy thing, and then,
then they had the guy from
then
space.
They brought in, the Great Gazoo,
right.
The Gruesomes, and they came in with all these gimmicky things, which was where television was going in the mid-60s with the Munsters and My Favorite Martian and all that.
So yeah.
They kind of copied all those things as well.
Well, tell us a little bit about this new book that you have out. You have three books that carry this little title, the Insight Mini Classics. What are they all about?
Well, last year, as you may know, I came out with a book called Hanna-Barbera Treasury, and that was an affectionate look at Hanna-Barbera cartoons of the 50s and 60s, mainly the TV cartoons. And it was really done through merchandising, through the merchandising art, the comic books, and we put cells and all sorts of unusual pieces, just to give the reader what I had hoped to do this, and I now know that I succeeded, having talked to many people who got the book, and that people got the idea that I wanted to relay, which was that this is what we love about Hanna-Barbera. I didn't come into this book. I basically told you about the characters, about the studio, but I'm not saying, you know, these cartoons are the greatest works of art. We grew up with them, and just by flipping the pages of this book, you're back in time. You're 7 years old, and this is like, this is how you love Hanna-Barbera. And I've gotten that reaction from a lot of people. It's really a big picture book is what it is, but the idea was to evoke that feeling, a feeling I hadn't gotten from any other book on Hanna-Barbera before. It was a big deal when I was getting involved with this project that I wanted to get that feeling through. It was something that was not coming through on all the other books, the few other books that were. Hanna-Barbera had written autobiographies, and there had been a couple of other books on Hanna-Barbera, and none of them captured the why we love them. And I did it not even with words, I did it with pictures in this particular book. Now, I say that, the book came out, it was actually a very big success for the publisher who did it, and so we really thought about ways to follow up this particular book. And what we came up with is what we call these little mini books. And we took, we're actually taking six of the main characters, and this year we're releasing three of them, and next year we'll release three more, and then I think we may do more after that. But we're taking them by character, and we're coming out with these little, like, called mini books that are like just devoted to the one character. And inside these, you'll get lots of information about, you know, those characters. There's a Tom and Jerry book, a Flintstones book, and a Scooby-Doo book that are out this year, and you'll find a whole bunch of interesting tidbits, timelines, artwork, and they're little tiny books though. I don't even remember how many pages they are, but they're little mini books that when you collect them, and the idea is that we're going to come out with three more next year, is that we want people to start to collect them like a little bookcase, little mini bookcase on Hanna-Barbera, and it's definitely different. Supplemental information than what we put in the other book, but to also keep up that fun atmosphere that we came through in the first book. We wanted to make sure people, you know, would pick these up and just go, oh yeah, oh right, you know, as you turn each page, and that's really what it is. It's very simple, and it's just a way to do more with the same characters and same things. We had so much more images and information that we didn't fit into the first one that we figured we could do this. And I'm continuing to do those Harvey Comics books. There's a Baby Huey one that's due out any moment, and we're doing one on little Audrey and little Dot and that kind of thing.
So those are books that collect the comic books, Baby Huey and so on, that were popular from Harvey Comics, and you offer commentary? Or you have an introduction to those?
I'm through Dark Horse books. We're doing a series of books. At the moment, it's five books. We're still wondering. We're figuring out if we're going to go beyond five at the moment. But the first three came out already: Casper, Richie Rich, and Hot Stuff. They're based on the Harvey Comics characters. We've gotten access to the original artwork for the comic books, and we're reprinting what we believe, me and Leslie Cabarga. Leslie's the editor of the series. I write an introduction, but Leslie and I work together, and we pick what we feel are like our favorite stories. We really like the ones that go way back to the 1950s, and then we work our way up into the 60s. We feel the artwork is the best, and a lot of it's done by animators from famous studios, the company that created Casper, the Paramount Studio.
And are you always able to figure out who the artists and writers were on these books?
Well, we don't identify each story, but we do talk about that in the introduction, and I do our best to try to inform people as to who the key artists are. In the case of the Baby Huey book, which came out this fall, you know, that was actually done mostly by the two main people who did the cartoons in the 1950s. Dave Tendlar, who was the director of the cartoons, he drew a lot of the early stories that really, really look like animation come to life on a page. And Marty Taras, who was the main animator of Baby Huey, but even more so, he was the actual creator of the character. He actually came up with the idea of the character and sold his bosses at that studio, and then ended up animating and then drawing a lot of comic books for the rest of his life. And so we have those, and both of us are really proud of that volume in particular, because I actually think, because most people don't really care about Baby Huey or have the least interest in it, we think.
I have a lot of affection for him.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you know that Baby Huey was also the nickname of Secretariat? The people who handled the horse, Secretariat, called him Baby Huey.
I wish you had told me that before I wrote my introduction. I did not know that. Right. I did know, and I thought you were going to say...
Call me next time.
Bill Clinton referred to himself as Baby Huey several times. And we have a direct quote from Time Magazine that we use in the introduction on this, too. Because he referred to himself as Baby Huey because he's clumsy and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
But
gigantic.
The term being referred to as Baby Huey, I think people still use that term today, and they don't even know where it comes from. They don't even know that it's from this cartoon character.
It's a very clever cartoon, which is available on DVD on the Harvey set. And what are some of the best cartoon DVDs that are coming out, coming our way soon, maybe that you provide commentary for?
The best ones that will be out this the end of the year here that I know of, and I'm happy to say that I worked on most of them, are Popeye Volume 3, which is the third of a great set of remastered the original Popeye cartoons from the 1930s and 40s. The Volume 3, which is just coming out, covers the wartime years, and there's been nothing held back here. We have... some cartoons that have really vicious wartime themes in them, cartoons that haven't been seen on TV probably in 30 or 40 years, if ever on TV, because they're very, very much versus the Japanese enemy or the Nazis, things like that. So there's some really, really good ones in there.
That'll be fun.
Completely restored. also, Looney Tunes Golden Collection Volume 6.
This is the last of the Looney Tunes collections?
It's the last of the Golden Collection series. It is not the last of Looney Tunes on DVD. We still plan to put out remastered, restored DVDs of Looney Tunes next year. It'll just be in a different format. It's hard for me to say right now what that is. We're still discussing it, but one of those ways is just by character. You know, there'll be like a Bugs Bunny collection or a Daffy Duck collection.
Now, with this collection, have all the cartoons that you curated on the previous Laserdisc collections been released on DVD?
No, and the reason for that is that we have more to work with now. What I mean by that is, on the DVDs, on the Laserdiscs, the Turner only owned about a fourth, or maybe a little more than that, maybe a third of the Warner Brothers cartoon library. And when we put out the Laserdiscs in the 90s, we were able to ultimately, in five volumes, put out every cartoon that he had the rights to, save for the censored 11 cartoons. But in the case, and today, in this decade, Warner Brothers now owns the rights to their entire library again. They have Turner's library of that one-third of the cartoons, plus they have their own library. They now own 100% of their cartoon library. And so we've been putting in, you know, cartoons from the 50s and 60s and the 30s and 40s, so we have much more to work with. There'll be more cartoons than ever on this next volume. I forgot the number, but usually we put 60 cartoons, and I think we have 75 or something like that on this new volume. And there's lots of bonus material and audio track commentaries and stuff like that. And, we definitely have plans for next year and the years to come. The goal by the people behind the scenes is to release all the cartoons ultimately, you know, on DVD. It's just they cost a lot of money to remaster these things, and they have a set budget. You know, it has to do with how they sell, how well they sell. If the cartoons collections sell phenomenally well, maybe they would up that budget. But we have a little limited budget to only do about 60 or 70 cartoons a year.
It's a pretty good deal considering how many cartoons you get for the price.
Yeah, no, it's a great deal, and really the six volumes, I mean, that's hundreds of cartoons. and yet I'll still get email from
how
people
come,
who are
yeah.
like, where's this one?
Where's that one about? Right.
Exactly. You know, and like, my favorite one you've never put on, that kind of thing. And I can only think to myself, I'm glad that there's still some great cartoons left for us to put out for next year and the years to come.
How many Warner Brothers cartoons do you think there are?
How many what?
How many Warner Brothers cartoons do you think there are?
Oh, well, we know that there's, from 1930 to 1969, there were 1,001 cartoons, but that doesn't count a lot of miscellaneous projects which we've included as bonus material on these things, and it doesn't count the, oh, I don't know, probably 24 newer Bugs Bunny cartoons that have been made in some subsequent years for TV specials or theatrical cartoons that they've made. So there's a bunch more than that, but it's about 1,000, and maybe we've released half the library. You got to remember that there's a decade that most there's two decades there's four decades of Warner Brothers cartoons, and two of them are really good, and the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And although I love the cartoons of the 30s and the 60s, as strange as the 60s got, a lot of people don't really care for those. In the 60s, you've got a lot of these bland Daffy Duck and Speedy Gonzales cartoons, you know, that just look like TV cartoons. And in the 30s, you've got a lot of black and white Bosco and Buddy cartoons, which a lot of people don't even know what that is, but that's the original, the earliest Looney Tunes cartoons that are based on songs, and I think they're great. I think they're loaded. They're really great from a film buff perspective. But animation people who love Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and those famous characters, well, that stuff didn't really start happening until the late 30s. So there's a bunch of those at 1,001 that a lot of people really don't have any feeling for. On this new Golden Collection set, we went out of our way to put cartoons on here that might not come out anytime soon after this set. What I mean by that is the thinking is that we will go in the future with sets devoted to characters, Foghorn Leghorn, Daffy Duck, that kind of thing. Where do we put in all of these really cool wartime cartoons that have never appeared anywhere? Where do we put in a lot of these great one-shot cartoons that really don't fit with a Bugs Bunny collection? You know, there's a whole bunch of these really, really off-the-wall one-shot wonders they did. And so we have a disc devoted to that. We have a disc devoted to wartime. We have one great disc that is just all the stars, all the Looney Tunes stars get one or two cartoons on the first disc. And I think the fourth disc is some of the great black and white ones that we may not put out anytime soon. Bosco and Buddy and early Porky Pig cartoons that really haven't been seen by a lot of people. So it's a real collector set. And Volume 6 is really for diehards, but if you're collecting the whole of the, you know, the all six of them, this is really something that needs to be in there. And we wouldn't have an opportunity, you know, in the near future to put these particular ones out. So I'm really, really happy that we got them out now.
Well, thanks for putting the effort in on those. We're excited.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as kids, you know, we all sat in front of the tube on Saturday morning for all this stuff. But then some people grew up, but not me or my guest, Jerry Beck. Jerry, thank you so much for being with us this week.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime you want to talk about cartoons, give me a call.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show. Be sure to stop back next week for another great program. Check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Thanks, as always, to the staff of From the Bookshelf, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks for listening. From KUSP Studios in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro.